Hi.
Welcome to Drinking the Kool-Aid.
Welcome.
I'm Megs.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm not going to lie, this is going to be a pretty rough story.
Okay. Thanks for the warning.
Yeah. So when we covered our last one on Margarita, I thought,
let's just keep that.
This really reminds me of another story.
Okay.
You know how I do.
Yeah, I sure do.
And so we're going to cover the case of Mary Vincent and Roxanne Hayes.
Okay.
The book I read was called The Mad Chopper by Fred Rosen.
Oh, dear God.
So you can already kind of guess that this is going to be very bad.
Yeah, I got that indication.
So, I mean, if you want a trigger warning, I will let you know right up front that there is going to be a little bit of discussion of rape. However, we will not do details.
Okay.
So that word will be used. And there is, of course, mutilation in this one.
Boy, this is going to be a rough one.
Yes.
All right.
And to start us off, we are going to discuss a 911 call. And Hannah is going to be the operator. And I am going to be the caller.
Holy hell, you literally meant at the very beginning.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
On February 9th, 1997, a 911 call was placed at 6.07 p.m. The frantic caller said, "He's beating a woman! He's beating a woman!"
Where is this, sir? And...
Listen, we just went to the house and there was this guy inside and he was beating this woman.
What's your name, sir?
My name's Jean Reynolds and it's that guy. That guy!
What guy, sir? Take your time. Just calm down.
Okay, okay, okay. Now, I don't know what the deal is, but the person that lives in that house is the same guy that cut that girl's arms off. The 15-year-old in California. Okay.
I'm so sorry. My eyeballs about popped out of my brain.
They really did. It was actually like a cartoon what it reminded me of just now.
Oh, God. Once you got to the end part of that, my eyeballs just got like huge because I was like, oh, God, this is gonna be a freaking wild one.
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot to this one, and this is gonna definitely be a three-parter. The operator was not sure what the caller was talking about, but she got the address and assured him that the police were on their way. But they weren't really coming fast. It took 34 minutes for the first police car with one Hillsborough County deputy to arrive.
Oh, no. Okay.
So this is like way too fucking long. The cops later explained that the call happened during a, quote, shift change time, and it was rush hour traffic.
Okay.
I don't want to critique it too hard here, but I will at least say that that's a problem.
Right.
The officer headed towards the house and spotted a Rottweiler guarding the door. The dog wasn't on a leash and was barking like crazy. So a neighbor that lived across the street saw the dog barking and the police parked in front of the house. And so he ran over and he was like, "Hey, I've got the dog. I'll tie her up." Officer Robbins said there was a report of a domestic disturbance. So the neighbor knocked on the front door of the home and he said, "Bill, the law's here." He continued knocking and suddenly the door swung open. And a naked man was standing there, covered in blood, wearing a condom.
Oh, boy.
He was staggering around, and the phone started ringing. The naked man didn't react to this noise at all, and the neighbor gently told him, "Bill, the phone's ringing." The man went back into the house to answer it, and Officer Robbins placed his hand on his weapon and followed him inside. On the other side of a narrow room, the deputy saw a woman's body lying on the couch. He went over to look, and he saw that she was covered in blood and she was dead. The naked man was standing over him now, with a sad look, but he said nothing. Robbins asked him what happened, but he didn't get a response. He quickly cuffed the man and told him he was under arrest for murder. This happened in 1997. To understand the full story, we have to go back 19 years.
That was a good setup.
You like that?
Yeah, I did, actually.
So we're going to table that part of the story for a while, but we will get back to it.
This feels like a TV show when, like, they show some crazy fucking shit happening.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden they, like, pump the brakes and they're like, 6 hours earlier.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
And you have to, like, wait the whole ass episode, and by the time you get to the end, you've forgotten about the beginning part, and you're like, oh, my God! That's what this feels like right
now. That's pretty much what's going to happen here.
Okay.
So just tuck that in your brain holes and we're coming back to it.
I'm buckling up.
Okay. In 1978, there was a corner near the University of California at Berkeley that the students referred to as Hitchhiker's Corner on University Avenue. You could go there and hitch a ride anywhere in the state, and a lot of times it would just be a student who would pick you up. On September 29th, 1978, 15-year-old Mary Vincent was hitchhiking. She grew up in Las Vegas, where her father was a mechanic and her mother was a blackjack dealer, but they were going through a really messy divorce. As Mary got into her teenage years, she began rebelling against her strict parents' rules, often skipped school, and would just leave town with her boyfriend. They even lived out of her boyfriend's car for a summer in Sausalito, California, until the authorities apprehended him on charges of raping another 15-year-old girl. She traveled to see his lawyer at the Marin County Civic Center, but she wasn't able to resolve anything. And the thing was, this boyfriend of hers was really the person that was taking care of her. So now she's just out on her own. After the arrest, Mary headed south and briefly lived with her uncle in SoCal, California. Then she headed towards Corona, California. That's a city just outside of Los Angeles, and that's where her grandfather lived. When her parents were going through the divorce, Mary needed more attention, and she just wasn't getting it at home. In the fall of 1978, she hitched a few rides to Northern California, where she thought she could find other artists like herself. She stayed in the Bay Area, homeless and living on the streets, until she got too homesick. She did apply for emergency public housing, but she wasn't able to get anything. And she wasn't ready to go back with her parents, but she did want to be around family. As she started her journey, she was picked up by a man who was alone in his car, and he drove her a little way. Then he dropped her off, and he gave her written directions to follow.
What? Okay.
So, to keep going on her journey.
Oh, to keep, okay. Just
like, here's a little map, you know, follow this. Because she's going to be hitchhiking.
Yep.
So, in most of the articles that I read, the stories were saying that Mary was heading to her grandfather's place in California, but other articles said she was leaving her grandfather's to head home. It was stated that she was traveling a little over 400 miles. In some places, I think it was stated as like 440. And Berkeley to Corona, when I Googled it, is 419 miles. So I do believe that she was going to her grandpa's place.
Okay. Man, I can't travel. I can't imagine traveling that long with a stranger. I hardly even like being in a car with like certain people that long. So well, I'm like, damn,
and
I get
several,
it. But
several strangers, right? You know, because she gets picked up multiple times. And the alternative is your ass is walking that many miles, you know? So next, she was picked up by a woman who had two men and a dog with her. They only traveled for about 15 miles together. Then the woman dropped her off at Hitchhiker's Corner in downtown Berkeley. Mary was wearing a light pink top, blue jeans, and white tennis shoes, carrying a green backpack and a reddish-purple knit purse. She was standing with a group of other people that were all waiting for a ride, and she was holding a sign that said she was going south. There were two other people behind her holding the same sign, going in the same general direction. A guy in a blue 1974 Ford Econoline van pulled up and said he could give her a ride, but in return, he needed her to help him load a few things into his van. So he's like, hey, we got to stop at my house. He didn't say where the house was, but he did say that it was nearby. The two guys that were standing behind Mary noticed that there was nothing else in the van. So he actually had room for all three of them. They were all going in the same general direction.
But he only wanted to take her?
Yeah. He insisted he only had room for one person, and it was Mary. The other two warned her, do not accept this ride. And they said, you know, it's just not safe because you're a young female and he only wants you to go. The man offering the ride appeared to be a little older, and Mary felt like he was almost a grandfather type, so she did accept the ride. The driver chatted with her for a while. He said his name was Larry, and they were driving north until they reached his house. Mary helped him load some stuff into the van, and then they headed back out. He told her that he had a daughter, but, you know, he failed to mention that he didn't see her anymore because he had been accused of beating her. So okay. That part was left out.
Of course.
He said that he had a second home in Nevada, and he talked about himself until they hit the freeway, and then Mary fell asleep.
Oh, God. Okay.
And you're
that's
right.
That's risky when...
Yes.
Yeah.
And you're right to be worried because this is where things go bad. So when she opened her eyes, she would have expected to see the lights of the San Francisco Bay Area, but they had passed Sacramento and were on their way east to Nevada. Mary shouted, they were going the wrong way. And Larry said, no, they're not. Mary said she knew Los Angeles was in the other direction. He stopped the van and he forced Mary towards the back. She picked up a stick that she found on the floor of the van and she hit Larry. So he actually backed off and he apologized. He was like, oh, you know, sorry, just got a little confused. And he promised to take her wherever she wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
As Larry drove, he reached under the seat and pulled out a bottle of whiskey. And he began drinking.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're really starting off bad here. He headed into Del Puerto Canyon, which was very isolated. And he said he was going to pull over so that they could go to the bathroom. Mary was going to run. She knew something was wrong. She was not safe. But when she looked down, she noticed that her shoe was untied. As they got out, she bent over to tie her shoe, and Larry hit her in the head with a sledgehammer. And she did black out.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously. When she came to, she was tied up in the back of the van. And trigger warning right here, he repeatedly raped her.
Oh, God. Okay.
She said at one point that she believed it might have been upwards of six times.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And then he told her that if she didn't scream, she could live. Then Larry fell asleep. Mary couldn't get herself untied, though, so she had to just stay there. When he woke up, he pulled her out of the van and raped her again, but this time he started squeezing her throat. He put her back in the van and drove farther into the canyon. Then he stopped beside a drainage pipe which ran under the two-lane road. Mary begged him to set her free, and she promised she would never tell anyone about this. He said, "You want to be set free? I'll set you free."
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, okay.
He pulled her out of the van, untied her, grabbed a hatchet from the toolbox, and cut her left arm off. Mary said that she reached out and gripped his arm really tight, but she couldn't understand why she was falling backwards. When she looked down, she realized her arm was gone and blood was gushing. Then he chopped her right arm off while she was kicking and screaming. She was aware of everything. She said the pain was excruciating, and she could feel the hot blood pumping out of her body. And I know this is really, really brutal and graphic. And I mean, obviously, I'm telling you things from her point of view. So if you haven't guessed it already, Mary does survive this attack.
Yeah, and this must be what like you were talking about in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
When he called 911 and was talking about the girl getting her arms chopped off.
Yes, that was a reference to her. Correct. Okay. So she was lying on the ground and she saw Larry off in the distance, and he was like standing by the side of the road, shaking his arms several times, and she didn't know what he was doing. Then she realized her severed arm was still grasping his.
Oh my God.
And he was trying to get it off.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. I know. He came back and he started dragging Mary's body. He scooped her up and tossed her over an embankment, which was a 30-foot cliff, and this broke four of her ribs, and the massive blood loss sent her body into shock. Then Larry climbed down and pulled her into the ditch and started kicking and shoving her into the drainage pipe to hide her body.
Oh my God.
This is just so over the top here. He grabbed her bloody hands and tossed them in the van and drove off.
What the fuck?
Now, at some point, which like still baffles me, Mary regained consciousness and tried crawling out of the drainage pipe, but she collapsed and lost consciousness again. Larry was gone, heading back west through the San Joaquin Valley, through the San Joaquin Pass until he got to the Oakland Bay Bridge. There wasn't a lot of traffic because it was so early in the morning. As he drove on the bridge's lower deck, he rolled his window down all the way and tossed Mary's arms out the window.
Oh, God, that is a gross sentence.
He is disgusting. When Mary woke up again, she was tired and cold. All she wanted was to just give in and sleep. But she heard a voice saying she couldn't sleep because he was going to do this to somebody else and she couldn't let that happen. So she's like not even worried about herself right now. You know, the fact that her arms were chopped off and everything and she was brutally attacked. She's like, I don't want this to happen to someone else.
I mean, incredible. And yes, you do what you have to do to get your will to survive.
Whatever it takes.
Yeah.
So she opens her eyes and she stuck her arms into the dirt to pack it into the wounds to stop some of the bleeding. And she managed to pull her naked body out of the pipe and she began walking out of the canyon. She remembered seeing Larry's itinerary in his van. She knew where he was going next. And she said, quote, I just kept locked in on him because he was on his way to his next victim, which was so gross to think about. Mary remembered when she was younger, quote, I was told that if you're bleeding and you don't have anything to cauterize it, stick your wound in the dirt until the blood congeals.
I mean, whoever taught her that, thank you.
Thank goodness that was a lesson because, I mean, that's crazy. I definitely, especially at 15, would never have thought to do something like that, you know? She said she doesn't know how she actually got up a 30-foot ravine, but she did. She said, I remember God said to just keep walking. I'll get you to safety. And I listened. She could hear the sound of cars, and by the time she reached the road, night had fallen. And remember, this attack happened early in the morning. So she saw a car, and it was sporty, and there were two guys in it. And she shouted, help me, but the driver got scared and sped past her. She had walked 2 miles in her condition, and another vehicle was finally approaching. She stood in the middle of the road, naked, covered in blood, holding what was left of her arms towards the sky. And a couple on their honeymoon had actually made a wrong turn, but they stopped when they saw her. Mary said, they were scared that whoever did this was still out there. The first thing I did was tell them they needed to get me to a cop so I could tell him where to go, how to stop him. As they were wheeling me into the hospital, I grabbed a cop and told them to get a paper and a pen. I started spilling my guts. I wanted to make damn certain they knew who he was when they saw his face. I described him like you would describe someone to a blind person.
That is just incredible.
That she has that wherewithal, you know, to even like think to do that. Mary had lost over half the blood in her body. And the blood that was left was at a toxic level. The surgeon amputated more of each forearm so she could be fitted with prosthetic arms in the future. As Mary was recovering in the hospital, the police knew they had to get as much information as possible to find out who attacked her. So she started going through everything. His name is Larry. He was a merchant seaman. He talked a lot. He had a home near the North Bay area, and there was a first aid kit that he had placed in the front window by the door. She was able to provide very detailed information about the house and Larry's dog. And he had
it's wild to me because, like, I try to pay attention, but, like, mm-hmm. damn, if somebody's that I'm, like, just riding with is telling me all about their home and shit, I'm going to probably tune out.
Well, and especially after losing that much blood and right. going through surgery and you're still able to remember all this, this is incredible. She said he had another home around Reno, and she described Larry, but she could not remember the exact location that he had actually picked her up from. There wasn't a lot to go on, but law enforcement received an APB, all points bulletin, on Larry, and the press began calling him the Mad Chopper. The information was sent over to Tom Mack, a sketch artist from the San Jose Police Department. Tom Mack spoke with Mary Vincent, and he drew up a picture of Larry based on her description. And she said the sketch looked just like him.
Sketch artists blow my mind.
I know. I agree.
I don't understand how they can listen to details and make it look exactly how you see it in your head, because, like, I can hardly describe things. And I'm like, how in the hell can you hear, oh, small nose, big nose, like this and this and this, and fucking make it look identical? I don't understand.
I know. I think it's very fascinating, too, because, like, I wouldn't be able to describe a face very well, I don't think.
No, I've literally thought about this. As, like,
it's a face.
Right. As I've watched certain TV shows and stuff, and they're, like, describing it, and then, like, I'm watching the sketch artist, like, make it happen, and I've, like, thought about, like, how the hell would I'm not even sure if I could describe Isaac's face enough for them to, like, be able to make a sketch. I look at his face all the time, and yeah. I'm still not sure I would have the ability to describe it to make it so that somebody could make it look like him.
No, I mean, I'm positive I could describe a cat face in perfect detail.
Wow.
But a human face, I just don't think so. I really don't.
Wow.
I know. But I stare at their faces so much.
Well, I mean, I think a cat face is a little different.
It could be. You'd be able to identify them, though.
Right. Well, yeah, that's true.
So the story went national, but they had to keep Mary's identity a secret because she was underage. So the media identified her under the pseudonym of Maria, which I don't think is very different from Mary, but okay, that's fine.
Yeah, like, no, it's not, but
sure.
Yeah.
A woman named Sandra Rubin picked up her morning paper and she was surprised to see a sketch of her former neighbor, Lawrence Singleton, on the front page. She looked again, and the nose was broader, the eyes were closer to the nose, the lips were thicker, and the hairline was further back, but, oh my God, it looked like him. She didn't want to accuse someone of something unless she was really sure, though, so she decided to think things over for a while. Detective Brashears had been trained in forensic hypnosis, and he was ordered by his boss to hypnotize Mary. This could help her recall details of the attack to see if they could get anything. And he explained to her that, you know, he would have her remember things in the third person as if it was happening to somebody else. And that way she could distance herself from the event.
Oh.
Especially since it's so fresh.
Okay.
So that's cool. She provided information about hitchhiking and the different people she interacted with that day. She also talked about going to Larry's house and said they had to pass over twin highway bridges. When the detective looked at a map, that meant they would have been headed into a town called Vallejo. He and his partner spent 5 days looking at every house in the town, trying to find one that was matching Mary's description. While they were trying to locate the house, the Modesto Police Department was getting thousands of tips, and there was one caller that had something interesting. Sandra Rubin. She just could not get that sketch out of her head. So she told them about her old neighbor, Larry Singleton, who had a blue van. Could fit. Sandra said she had moved a few years ago, but when the police checked, they saw that Larry Singleton still lived in that same house. He was a merchant seaman, and he had a daughter who lived in a house in Sparks, Nevada. Detective Brashears and his partner Reese traveled to Larry Singleton's home. No one was there, but sitting in the front window was the first aid kit, just like Mary described. Brashears and Reese went to the local convenience store to call the information in, and once they got their warrant, they went back to the house. They knocked, no one answered, and they broke the door down. They were hit with the smell of dogs, which is another thing that Mary had described. When Larry brought her to the house, they had actually loaded several bags of dog food into the van. She had given a really accurate description of the inside of the house, especially the fireplace. In the charcoal debris, Brashears found cloth remnants. Mary had been naked after her attack. Larry had stashed her body in a drainage pipe, removed her arms to get rid of fingerprints, and burned her clothing. Larry was later arrested at the home of his estranged wife, Celia Johnson, in Sparks, Nevada. A neighbor said, quote, "He was a peach of a guy."
Oh.
Which
Okay.
I don't even know why you would say something like that after someone's in trouble, but okay.
I don't feel like he is, but
I don't either.
Yep.
He said that Larry's hobby was making macrame plant hangers, and he was described as very quiet. Most of the people that knew him said they honestly couldn't believe it. Larry Singleton had a police record of minor violations, and they were involving alcohol. And his most recent was a drunk driving arrest on April 30th. But he didn't have a record of violent sex crimes. Like, nothing escalated to this level, at least. Larry was sent back to Modesto for questioning, and he politely referred to the cops as "sir" during the interview. The interview began, and he was asked to describe what he did on September 29th. He said that he left San Francisco and went to Berkeley. He picked up a young lady who was hitchhiking and offered her a ride if she agreed to help him load some stuff into the van. He said they picked up dirty clothes and dog food. So he admitted to picking up Mary.
But then conveniently left the rest out.
Well, here's where he started to change things. Mary wanted to get to her grandfather's house, but Larry said that the lady he picked up was on her way to her sister's house in Reno. He said that he stopped for gas in Auburn, and he went to the bathroom. When he got back, Mary had a stick and beat him in the head and said, "You better drive me to LA instead."
Oh.
So now Mary's the aggressor.
Right.
In his version.
But, she did beat him with a stick, but he was fucking driving her the wrong direction.
That's correct. Exactly. And Mary did admit to the detectives that, yes, she did hit him with a stick.
I'm glad she did.
Yeah, I wish she would have gotten more.
Right.
He said that he told her he could just take her over to the ramp where she could find a ride with somebody else. You know, because she's scaring him. She's being too aggressive.
Oh, okay.
But she refused this and said no. He better take her to L.A. or she was going to stick him in the eyes and the stomach, too.
Oh, no, not with the stick.
Mm-hmm. So he agreed to take her anywhere she wanted to go.
Mm.
Now, I will warn you, his version of events is wildly ridiculous. But I still want to go through it.
Okay. Well, yeah. This is going to be something.
Yep. That's what we'll call it. So he said, and just keep in mind, all this stuff is pure bullshit, okay?
Oh, yeah.
He said that she told him that if he was bullshitting her, she was just going to tell everybody that he assaulted her. The two of them.
Oh, I see what he's trying to do. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's super easy for him to kind of twist everything and make her look like the shitty person here. So the two of them ate at an A&W. Then he drove to a store so he could grab some cigarettes. When they got back on the freeway, there were two guys hitchhiking. And so Mary was like, hey, we need to pick them up. So they did. One guy was almost Larry's size with blonde hair and a weather-beaten beard, maybe about 35 years old, wearing a denim jacket, denim pants, and a grayish sweater. The other guy was Mexican, 5'6", heavyset, and it was hard to tell his age. He could have been about 30 to 40, or maybe 25. He was wearing an old military wool coat, or a leather one. It looked like an Eisenhower jacket that was faded brown, with a sweater and heavy gray pants. So you can see he's really trying to work in a lot of detail.
Yeah, and I'm already like over here like, that's such bullshit because I can't even remember what you wore yesterday. And I was with mom for like quite a while, and the only thing I remember is her wearing a cardigan that I liked because I kept complimenting it. What she wore aside from that, couldn't tell you.
Yeah, and somehow he's remembering a lot of detail.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He said that Mary started complaining as soon as the guys got in and telling them how terrible he was. And so she's talking to the other hitchhikers
just
about
right in
him.
Front of the guy.
Yes.
Got it.
Larry Singleton said that one of the hitchhikers was named Larry.
Oh, wow, this is turning into quite a tale.
And the other one was Pedro.
God, Larry. I thought you were going to say Barry. I was like, really? Mary, Larry, Barry? Like,
ooh. That would have been perfect. We'll see if he can revise that. So Larry Singleton was drinking and driving. So he admits here that he was doing that. So that is true.
So he's literally sprinkling in like the teensiest, weensiest little truth nuggets.
Yes.
Among all his little bullshit lies.
And anything that can be used to his advantage here. Right. Which this could. So he pours himself another drink, and Mary suggests that hitchhiker Larry should take over and drive for a while since he's drinking. Larry Singleton did not want the other Larry to drive, but he went along with it because Mary had a knife. Where did she get this knife? Who knows, but now she has a knife.
Oh, so she has a knife and he's drunk driving, and he's just like, mm-hmm. No big deal. I'm just going to drink while you're sitting there with your knife.
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
Wow.
Next, he says that Mary announced that she wanted to get stoned. So Larry handed the hitchhikers some money and told them to make it happen. And so All three of the hitchhikers are now high.
Okay.
At the next stop, hitchhiker Larry and Pedro went to a pickup truck, got two packages, and Larry Singleton assumed that they had to have been doing cocaine. Because they were sniffing when they got back in.
Wow.
Soon, all three hitchhikers were drinking and sniffing.
Everybody is getting turned in there, man.
Yeah.
So wow.
They're all partying and feeling good. And Larry Singleton asked Mary how much she would charge to make love to everybody.
Okay.
And he said he was only kidding, but she laughed and laughed. She thought this was so funny. And so he gave her $80, and she said, you know what? And I'll tell you, this is vulgar. He claims that Mary looked at him and said, I really like to suck cocks.
Wow.
Yeah, so apparently that's coming out of a 15-year-old's mouth.
This is... Wow.
Okay.
This is a story.
Yep. So she gave hitchhiker Larry a blowjob. Then Larry Singleton got one too, but she refused to give one to Pedro.
Hitchhiker Larry is having a good time.
A lot's happening to hitchhiker Larry.
Yeah, for sure.
Detective Brashears knew that Larry Singleton was lying. Obviously, there's no evidence of the two male hitchhikers that he described, and Mary was adamant that she was in the van with one person, and that was Larry Singleton. They did not pick anyone else up.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I gathered.
Right. Larry Singleton said they had all been drinking heavily and Pedro started driving while Mary and hitchhiker Larry were having sex.
Like you said, hitchhiker Larry, man.
A lot's happening to him.
He is just having a time in there.
He knows how to party. So while all of this is happening, Larry Singleton was sleeping.
Okay.
All right, so they're having sex in the van, and he's taking a nap. When he woke up...
As one does.
Yes, that would happen, sure. So when he woke up, they were almost to the area where the highway splits in San Francisco. He said Pedro was driving erratically, so he told him he could take over. And that's when he realized, oh my gosh.
We're going the wrong way.
No, Mary's not in the van anymore.
Oh my God.
So he asked, where is she? And they said, she's already got her hands in the till. She's no good. So they sent her to LA. And I tried to look up what the hell that phrase means. And it looks like it's a way of accusing someone of stealing money.
That's what it sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, their hand is in the till.
Right.
So, okay, now.
But I see like that disgusting fucking thing he put in there.
Yeah, so now yeah. Now she steals. Okay.
Just and because like he said her hands.
Hands in yeah. the till. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Detective Brashears stopped Larry and he was like, okay, what about her clothes? What did you think when you found out her clothes were still in the van? Larry was surprised and he's like, her clothes weren't in the van. He said that he dropped off the male hitchhikers in San Francisco and he headed on his way. He went home to sleep. The detectives started poking holes in the story and they were pointing out all the inconsistencies to him, which there are many. He said that he had been wearing blue coveralls and that they were in the trunk of his T-Bird, but they weren't there. He said that he owned a small hatchet located in his blue toolbox, but it wasn't there. He was asked if there would be any blood on the coveralls when they found them, and he said no. Then later he said, oh, wait. We were actually horsing around in the van, and Mary got a bloody nose.
Okay.
Yeah.
Must have been from all that coke she was snorting.
It had to have been. They were drinking and sniffing. Larry said that the lady that rents the house from him had washed all his clothing, and then somebody else had... helped him to clean out his van.
Well, that was very nice of them.
It sure is, because, you know, when somebody that I know, you know, in my neighborhood goes on a vacation and comes back, I usually help them wash their clothing.
Yeah, totally. And then clean out their car.
Yes, that's a thing that we do often. He said that he burned some old rags and papers in his fireplace. The detectives asked where the rags came from. And he said they came from work, so they're all different colors. And they were like, okay, so if they came from work, it should be all of the same material then, right? And he was like, no, actually, it's supplied by a linen shop. So we just get a bundle of different materials.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Wow. How would you even keep up with the story again if you had to?
I don't have a clue.
Like, if they asked you to retell it.
Right. He just changes course so like, often.
My God.
Mm-hmm. There's an excuse for everything here. So they pressed him harder. Were there any female clothes in the rags? Larry said, no. And they even added in. They were like, okay, what about your daughter's clothes? And Larry said, oh, yeah. She left a white blouse at the house.
No.
Brashear said, what about the bras and underwear? How did that end up in your dirty clothes? Larry said, well, his ex-wife passed away and her clothes were still at the house. Brashear said, no, the bras were for a small person. This wouldn't fit your deceased wife.
And they're very different.
Yeah.
Like, holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
That is the dumbest shit ever because they are very, very, very different. You can very clearly tell when a bra is for a child versus an adult.
Well, now that they can't fit his wife, he said, oh, yeah, they're my daughters.
Oh, yeah. They were my dead wives, but actually they're my daughters.
Yes.
Okay.
Larry's daughter had already been interviewed and she had not been in the house since the beginning of the summer. And this took place in September. So.
Mm-hmm.
The interview was starting to get to him. He was tripping up on some of his answers, and the detectives noticed the little beads of sweat coming down his face.
So, yeah, from all that work of trying to come up with this bullshit.
Uh-huh. So they asked him again about that hatchet. He described it and said there's a little piece of rope that's attached to it. And Brashear said, yeah, he noticed that rope and it had been cut. Why is that? Larry said he had been moving furniture and he cut the rope with a knife. Interesting. Brashear said, you're a seaman. You don't cut knots. You tie them. You wouldn't cut them with a knife, would you? That's when he told Larry that he already spoke with Mary several times and she was awake the entire time when he cut her arms off. He, of course, denied any involvement and said he would swear on a Bible that he did not cut her arms off. He said he just didn't have the guts to do something like that.
Shit, let him swear on the Bible.
Oh, gosh.
I'm just, yeah. Just let it happen.
Oh, Larry. He claimed that Mary was racist. Because remember earlier, she refused to give hitchhiker Pedro the blowjob.
Oh,
but the
right.
other two Larrys got them. So now she's racist. And he says she was a sex worker.
Wow.
Neither of these things would be relevant, but okay, Larry. Sal Benedetto got up early one morning, did some chores, and headed out fishing around noon. It was a weekday, so nobody was around, and he headed to his favorite shoreline under the bridge. He was all set up for a relaxing day, and he saw something out of the corner of his eyes. He couldn't quite tell what it was, but he thought the sun was maybe messing with his vision, so he got closer, and that's when he realized he was looking at a right hand.
Okay.
Mary Vincent's hand was lying on the rocks. It had been 10 days since the attack, so there was plenty of decomposition, but there was a reddish-brown nail polish on the tip of the right thumbnail. Mary had been wearing red nail polish on the day of her attack. Doctors in Modesto sent fragments of bone that were taken during her surgery, and it was compared to the bones in the right hand, and it was a match. What are the odds? Her hand had been tossed into the San Francisco Bay and somehow swept up on the rocks intact. The author explained that the natural gas builds up in decomposing human tissue. The gas had kept the hand afloat, allowing it to sail across the water like a piece of driftwood. If the bloating hadn't occurred, then it would have sunk to the bottom of the bay and, of course, been, like, eaten.
Or if it was, like, your dad's arms, because for some fucking reason you two don't float.
That's true.
Yeah.
We sink right to the bottom.
I mean, Mom would be pretty solid. I think our body parts would just float on out.
Yeah.
Because we both float like crazy, but you two just bloop right down.
Yeah, like in pools, my dad and I cannot float on our backs or anything, like, whoop, right
it's
down
very
the bottom.
Weird. It's
yeah.
very, very weird. Like, literally, Megan lays on her back, and she just, like, sinks like a fucking rock. Yeah. It makes no sense. I cannot make sense of it. Me and my mom will be just like floating on our backs around
for hours,
and they just bloop right down.
Yeah,
like if we're ever in a shipwreck,
we're
they're
goners.
Screwed.
Yeah,
they are totally screwed.
You
and
guys
me and my
will
mom
float back.
We'll just float on back, and you two will be gone.
Yeah,
because for some reason, you guys just. Straight to the bottom.
Yes.
I will never get that.
Nope. I have no idea why. I'm sure there's some scientific reason, but...
There probably is, but it is very weird.
Yep. Away we go. While Mary was recovering in the hospital, people were trying to figure out how to help her. And things got a little tricky. California had a state program that helped victims of violent crimes, but Mary wasn't actually a resident of California. She had been living with her boyfriend, Diego, in California, but She was a minor, so her place of residence was determined by where her parents lived, and that was Nevada. This meant that California could not help her, so her parents would need to file for assistance. Private contributions were sent to the family to help, and while any amount is certainly generous, they only received a total of $300. And her medical costs were going to be way over $10,000, and that wasn't even including the new arms that needed to be paid for.
Yep.
On October 27th, 1978, Mary had to testify before the Stanislaus County Grand Jury about the details of the crime. It was difficult for her to get through her story, and it was difficult for the jurors to hear it. Mary said, quote, "At that moment, there was no fear, just anger. I wanted to kill him. I don't ever want to feel that angry again. It was horrible." District Attorney Donald Stahl said, quote, "I think she displayed a lot of courage. I think she showed a lot of courage throughout this whole damn thing." He also said there was no credence to the charge that Larry Singleton had leveled against Mary, saying that she accepted money from him for sex, and there wasn't any evidence that he ever picked up two other hitchhikers, Larry and Pedro.
What?
I know, what a surprise.
They didn't exist? Oh my God.
I'm baffled. Todd Meadows, one of the honeymooners that picked Mary up after the attack and got her help, had also testified, and Detective Reese read the statement Larry Singleton had made at the time of his arrest. Larry did not appear since it wasn't required. The Stanislaus County Grand Jury reached its conclusion, and Larry Singleton was brought in for the formal reading of the indictment in front of Superior Court Judge Francis W. Halley. The clerk said, quote, "Lawrence Singleton, you are charged with one count of forcible rape, two counts of forcible copulation, one count of sodomy, one count of kidnapping, one count of mayhem, and one count of attempted murder." He had a total of seven charges, and bail was set at $200,000.
Should have had a count in there for being a fucking idiot.
I wish that that was something that they could do. It was rumored that Larry had family in Florida that was paying for his legal representation. And based off what we find out later about the family, I'm sure that this was true. So.
Okay.
Alcohol abuse experts were consulted by the police and prosecutors. Larry talked about consuming tons of alcohol on the day that Mary was attacked. So they wondered, could a person that was in an alcoholic blackout commit this kind of crime and have no memory of it?
I'm going to say no.
Okay.
Not only because, holy shit, I don't care how blacked out you are, that is something that's going to be in there.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if he was blacked out, he would not have made up all the random bullshit about the people being involved and doing all the drugs and being drunk with him and all that crap.
Right. Yep. If the answer was yes, that could mean that Larry could use a diminished capacity defense at trial.
Oh, hell.
But if the answer was no, he would then have to convince the jury that the other hitchhikers, Larry and Pedro, actually existed and committed the crime. The answer came back as no. The alcohol abuse expert said that a person couldn't just hack Mary's arms off during an alcoholic blackout and have no memory of it, just like you were saying. They explained that alcohol would act as a triggering mechanism, releasing the pent-up rage and sadistic impulses that dwell below the surface of a person's consciousness. Released from his ego, he would be free to act out. So someone who drinks heavily can suffer blackouts, but it doesn't erase their moral code. If you think it's wrong to cut somebody's arms off when you're sober, you also think it's wrong when you're drunk.
Right.
On the flip side, if he's a violent person when he's sober, he can be violent when drunk.
Yep.
Regardless, the individual's responsible for their actions, and that's what they needed to know. So that's where we're going to end this one. And we have a lot more coming up.
I feel like we do.
So, we'll have to get through the trial. And then there's a big snafu when it comes to Larry getting released.
Yeah, well, I figured as much because of the 911 call.
Yeah.
I stored that in there. You told me to.
I did. Yes, we will circle back to that, of course.
Yeah, so, and the fact that somebody had to say, like, I think it's this person, that clearly means he was released at some point, so.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, we'll go through, like, how his sentence worked, and then, you know, after he actually gets released, there was a lot of people that were not happy about it, and it just created a lot of extra work and issues. So.
Okay.
You'll find out. All right. So make sure to follow us on any of your podcast apps. Tell us the stories you want to hear. Like us on Facebook, X, Instagram. Leave us a 5-star review if you love us. Tell your friends. Tell your cats. Bye.